welcome to Books on the Go, a podcast where we talk about our book of the week. I'm Anna Bailey-Karras and I'm here with Annie Waters. Hi, Annie.
Hello.
And this week we've been reading The Trees by Percival Everett. But first, book news, and in legal news, which is a first for us, the court, but it's just such an interesting case. In the US, the court has just blocked the acquisition by Penguin Random House of Simon & Schuster. So that's a case that ran for several months and probably has been
ongoing
for longer. The court blocked the acquisition because they said it would lead to a substantial lessening of competition, because there would only be three or four major publishing houses. Annie will know better than me.
You're going from three majors to two.
Yes.
I think.
But Annie, you just raised the question just before we started recording of what would happen if Penguin Random House doesn't buy Simon & Schuster. It will fold, did you think?
I think so. Well, I don't think anyone else has the money to buy it. It's $2.2 billion that they've offered for the sale, and I don't think anyone else seems to be in contention for it. So, yeah, then I guess it gets split up between all the other publishing houses, which essentially has the same effect as diluting the market, you know.
Yeah, so that is interesting to me as to whether – well, the court would know that. But
maybe that's more even, you know, if you divide it between the remaining major houses. I think – I don't know. I think independent publishers face the same
– still highly concentrated.
Well, exactly. And in the indies still have the same problems that they have today of breaking into the market, where they already have such a small market share. They publish a percentage of the authors that the big houses can publish in a year, and they have a percentage of the – like a tiny percentage of the marketing budget to devote to them.
Exactly.
But that's why they have to be niche, and well, some of those awards recently,
that gives them momentum, doesn't it?
And you have a bit more integrity, I think, as a smaller publisher.
Well, we need them because we need that
absolutely
diversity in publishing. In other news, in prize news, the Scotiabank Giller Prize has been awarded, which is the highest literary prize in Canada. It's a $100,000 prize, and each of the shortlisted authors each received $10,000. So quite
very
generous prize. And the winner was Suzette Mayer for her novel, The Sleeping Car Porter. I have not read it. Do you know anything about it, Annie?
No, nothing at all.
No.
Because that's a Canadian-based prize, isn't it?
Yes.
So, yeah, they often don't break through into our market until they win something like this or
– Yeah. Well, this wasn't even in the news site that I normally go to for book news. This wasn't even mentioned. It's just that a friend had mentioned it to me. So you're right. It's so – I don't know why, but – Canadian books seem to go under the radar in Australia, at least.
I guess in a similar way that Australian books would go under the radar in the US.
That's just true.
they're seen as very local stories.
Yeah,
but I mean, someone like Mary Lawson, who I'm pretty sure won the Giller Prize years and years ago, has now broken through with her Booker nomination, and she's a beautiful writer. You know, I don't see why.
Oh, no, but that's – I feel like we miss out.
Totally.
Because we don't hear enough about them. So that's Suzette Mayer. So we'll keep an eye out for that, although I won't be buying it because I'm still on the book ban.
Very good of you.
And in Keep or Cull, Annie, you've been culling or keeping something.
Well, I've just been reading them, which is good. So I think I'll cull one and keep one, but I finished both. So I went on a very quick trip to Canberra to see my best friend and see an exhibition, the Cressida Campbell exhibition at the gallery.
Fantastic.
It was amazing. I loved it. And I read Salonika Burning by Gail Jones on the way over there, and I really loved that. It's about four real people who were in or around Salonika, the Saloniki in Greece, around the time of the First World War when Salonika burned to the ground. And so it's around these four characters. She puts them all in the same situation, and with this very high intensity backdrop, creates a really human drama about the perils of war and what happens to people when they go through that. So, yeah, I really loved that. I love Gail Jones. So that was great. And then on the way home, I read The Christmas Murder Game by Alexandra Benedict is her name. And it's a very silly, very Agatha Christie-like kind of murder mystery puzzle in which a young woman has to return to the house of where her mother was murdered and discover the secrets behind her family over the 12 days of Christmas. And people are dropping dead like flies. They're getting sonnets with clues in them from her aunt. It's very silly, but it was a great plain read.
Good plain read.
So I can give that one away now. I've finished it, but I'll keep Salonika Burning.
Fantastic. My keep or cull, one of them that I read was Crossroads by Jonathan Franzen, which I will do with Amanda, I think, on the podcast. So I'll save the discussion for that. and historical crime novel called A Necessary Evil by Abir Mukherjee. And I really like his work because it has such a great sense of place in Calcutta and around India.
This one in the 40s, is that right?
In the 20s.
Okay.
So during the time of the British rule of India, with one British police detective, I think, and one, he has an Indian colleague called, he calls Surendranath because he can't pronounce the name. So it's because it's written from the, you know, the author is Indian Scottish, so there's that authenticity to it, and he's asked his parents and his relatives for stories of that time, and to, and he's researched it to get an understanding because he was curious about that history. But it's got a light touch, he's got a sense of humour. This one wasn't my favourite. There were just so many things going on and I couldn't quite keep track of. It was a bit over the top, but you really do feel like you're going into that colonial India in colonial times and getting a few home truths about that along the way, but with a nice, you know, sense of humour.
Yeah.
And apparently Smoke and Ashes, which I think is the third one, is even better. So sometimes the third or fourth one, they really pick up their stride and gets better. But anyway, that's just a nice, if you enjoy a crime series, murder mystery. Now on to our book of the week. And I said to Annie that I would introduce this and then I've failed to do any research. So we're just going to wing it. But it's The Trees by Percival Everett. And Percival Everett is an American author. He's written over 30 novels. And we, and I'm sure many of our listeners would be in the same boat, well, particularly if you don't live in America, but had not heard of Percival Everett until this year when he was shortlisted for the Booker Prize with The Trees. And I have heard when that happened, there was a lot of commentary from lovers of his books saying, I'm so happy he's finally getting the recognition he deserves, and, you know, really thrilled for him. And we're very late to the party, basically, Annie. But he's an American author, and his previous novel, Telephone, was a finalist in the 2021 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction and also received another award. And he also teaches at the University of Southern California. So The Trees is set in a place called Money, Mississippi, and it starts off with a white man, Junior Malam, being brutally murdered. The police are stumped. Then his cousin is found dead, and there seems to be a serial killer, but there's also a very confusing element of both killings, is that there's a black man found dead at the scene as well, but it's the same black man at each scene. So when the police are coming to remove the bodies, somehow this dead black man, or who they thought was dead, has escaped. And you can already tell there's an absurdist element to this story, and it's certainly written in a satirical tone that can at times be really uncomfortable because of the issues that it's talking about. But in any case, they get the Mississippi Bureau of Investigation to step in. So we're going along on this absurdist path, and there's two detectives, Ed and Jim, who are fantastic characters. They step in, they're totally flummoxed as well, and in the end they end up needing the FBI as well. So they get Herberta Hind from the FBI, who's another excellent character, and it becomes bigger and bigger. So that Matthew Schirrapa, when he was reviewing this, says that it starts quite small, so they literally start honing in on one family, and then it becomes a bigger and bigger book or a bigger story, which I think is a good way to describe it. But anyway, series of murders happens, that's not a spoiler, and you follow Ed and Jim as they try to solve the murders, and you with as well the local white police officers and the local community. They start to get a sense that someone's behind all of this, and indeed maybe a group of people are behind these murders, these killings, and it starts to link up with the history of lynching in America. And they go and visit a local woman who is documenting this history, and that seems to be relevant to the case, and they're trying to piece it all together. So it's hard to define what the genre is, but it's been described as a satirical horror fantasy. It was shortlisted for the 2022 Booker Prize, as we mentioned. It won the 2022 Annisfeld Wolf Book Award. It was a finalist for the Penn Jean Stein Book Award, and longlisted for the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. The New York Times Book Review said Everett has mastered the movement between unspeakable terror and knockout comedy. The Booker judges said a page turner with a sharp, provocative edge as it harks back to the real life murder of the young Emmett Till. It has important things to say about race. NPR said it's a high wire combination of a whodunit, horror, humour, and razor blade sharp insight, a tribute of a novel hard to put down, impossible to forget. Gory pulp revenge fantasy. That was the quote from Book Forum. And, you know, fierce satire. Mm. So that might give you a sense of the tone and the style of it. What did you think, Annie?
Oh, I absolutely loved it. Lots of the reviews I read compared it to Jordan Peele's films, which I think is quite accurate.
Because I could see it as a film.
Oh, totally. It's so filmic. And it reminded me a lot of another film called Sorry to Bother You, which is by Boots Riley, which I loved. And it's got this same kind of bewildering, angry satire, I guess. And it's not so much against any person or people, it's just against the world and this really awful situation that you've inherited and continues to perpetuate itself. And what else can you do but laugh? And, you know, I think the cops, Ed and Jim, kind of personify that the most.
Yes.
You know, they have this really blasé attitude to these gruesome things that they see in their everyday job, and they've become really inured to it because they have to. Mm. And at the same time, they've become really inured to the casual racism that they experience every day. You know, these two very black cops arrive in very white money Mississippi. All these people are having to stop themselves saying the N-word out loud in front of them. And, you know, there's this charade of politeness, which is very, very thin, and they can see through immediately. And they kind of just poke fun at it. You know, I think there's at one point the two black cops and Herbie Hind, which is just such a great name, get pulled over by a state trooper, and they're kind of playing it up and saying, oh, what did we do wrong? Were we speeding? Rara? And the state trooper says, right, I'm going to need you all to get out of the car and put your hands. And they're like, can we put these badges down first? And they all show their badges. And then he's like, oh, I should shoot you.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, oh, well, he could, you know, like it's a real threat, but I guess they have to find a way to live through that reality. So yeah, I loved all of those kind of beat moments. There's a lot of humor. I think it's a real whiplash of a book in terms of you swing from laughing out loud to kind of gasping or really being emotionally struck by the intensity of either the murders or the racism that's prevalent in this little town and across America. And it is very, very thinly hidden behind even closed doors or not even closed doors.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it kind of gets into lots of things about history of lynchings but also the Ku Klux Klan and things like that. Yeah, I loved it. What did you think?
Didn't quite hit for me.
Okay.
Didn't quite land, but I really loved elements of it. It was such a strange experience because I loved elements of it. I enjoyed the Jim and Ed scenes, and the humour is spot on.
Mm.
He doesn't place a foot wrong. It's more that the tone of it I found myself disengaging from, and I think partly because it's set up really as a fantasy. So there's some elements of it that are not realistic, mm-hmm. and indeed the whole premise of it is not quite real.
Mm.
And so because that's not a genre I enjoy, and it just requires such a leap of faith to then think, okay, but we'll pretend that that's happening. And so it takes me much longer to then connect with the story.
Mm.
And then the tone being satirical, which is also putting you at a distance in a way, it's quite flippant, even though he's not, we understand that he's not being flippant about these issues, quite the reverse, but the tone is presenting itself as quite flip and funny and we're just going to laugh about it.
Mm.
And so that is...
It's jarring
is the word. And I know that was intended. I think it's a really strong book, but that combined with the fact that it's also a fantasy horror genre, which is not my thing. There were really, which I'll go into, things that I thought were excellent. But the other thing that troubled me, because of course you're laughing, but also as you mentioned, it then makes you think about these really serious issues. And what I found a bit, I suppose, pessimistic about it was that the fantasy is, well, what if black Americans took back power or had the power?
Mm.
A bit like in Naomi Alderman's book, The Power, where what if women could kill you with a zap from their hand? And in both books, the sort of outcome of it is a very aggressive, violent, to me, pessimistic outlook on the human race and what would happen. And whilst you can understand the revenge impulse, well, we can't fully understand it, but we can imagine, I still just found that it was a very, very brutal masculine tone.
I think it's realistic though, you know, like if, I mean, I'm fully on board with the fact that an uprising of this kind won't happen in our world. It's not.
Well, it might happen. I mean, he's making
in
you
a different
think,
way. In a different way,
it makes you think. Well, it could. You know, perhaps it could happen. But I just found the following that to its logical conclusion, and his suggestion is that it would all be incredibly violent, and that they'd basically repeat what white people did.
I think he's not offering this as a solution, though. I think this is a cathartic book to write and to read. But I don't think, I agree with you, I don't think that the ending really justifies the means. And I think that it gets out of hand from the initial people who were kind of organising it.
They never intended
this kind of wave of retributive justice to happen.
More momentum and than it doesn't, they intended.
It doesn't provide justice in the same way. I think forgiveness, reconciliation comes through the character of the academic character who goes and stays with Mama Z.
Oh, yes.
And so Mama Z has catalogued all of the lynchings in the US since 1913, which is when she was born. There's over 7,000 of these files that she has in her house. Her father was lynched when she was very little. And he goes through and reads these files and starts writing them out by hand and then typing them out. And that, he says he's going to, once he's written them all out, he's going to then erase each one of them and set them free. And I think that is more so the point of the book, that it's kind of like we need to be talking about these people as people. They're not just statistics. They're not just numbers. And it continues to happen in huge numbers, and people are not very good at imagining things in a scale
numbers.
Like this. But if you give those people names, and I kept wondering, and I couldn't find in reviews or whatnot, but he has, you know, 3 or 4 pages of these people's names, and I assume that they're all real people. There are definitely names that I recognised in there. This is kind of bearing witness to these people's lives, and even the unknown males or unknown females, you know, who aren't documented, they still get a place in the record. So that, I loved that, and I'm really bad at reading lists and lines of poetry and things like that, but I really tried to read every single name and get the point that he was making.
You're right. I suppose it does show different responses, but it made it just so dissonant with the fact that it's quite funny to read and yet quite bleak, I think really quite bleak. But the humour was great, and that's what made me think of it as something on screen, because you've got these great characters. It's very strong. He does it so precisely, so the dialogue is really on point. So there's a scene in the funeral home where the funeral director's speaking to this simple redneck, basically this woman who's lost her husband, and he's saying, and what would you like to do with the dearly departed? And she's saying, with the what? And they have this very funny interaction. And then there's a scene later on with the president, who is clearly Trump or modelled on Trump. And when it's getting out of hand, and I don't think it's a spoiler to say they're trying to secure him, and they say, the first lady's secured, Mr. President. And he says, who? And they say,
I think he says, Melanie.
Your wife. No, they say, your wife.
Oh, yeah.
Your wife. And then he says, oh, Melanie. Oh, thank you. That's good. And they say, oh, no, Melania. So it's really funny and almost superfluous in a way. I mean, do
totally.
We need to be.
But I think it escalates. The humour and the violence escalate through the book. And I think that matching of pitch, you know, getting more and more ridiculous. So the names are so good. And towards the end, there are a few, I think just in that last, I don't know, 50 pages, there's a police chief or someone called Pinch Wayface, and then his deputy is Chalk Pellucid.
Yeah.
And it's just like he's thrown all kind of conventions out the window.
Yeah.
The names themselves just like conjure these absolute bumbling idiots. Yes. People, they could stand in for any number of real politicians or, you know, figureheads in that way. So that just kept me laughing. Yeah, I think what you're saying about the way that he captures the manner of speaking of that kind of very hillbilly, redneck
straight
community. Yeah.
So it's really, really well done. I think I just found it hard. I can imagine this as quite a funny movie and yet it's not, the story isn't funny, and I don't know that he really wants us to be laughing or not. I'm not sure. So
I think the humor almost, I don't know how this would play if I were black, but for me as a white audience, I think the humor almost makes you complicit in the atrocity. And so it's really, you're laughing, but you're also cringing, and you're feeling like, especially that first scene, you kind of have this gathering of real rednecks and they're talking about, can I keep my pigs in your pool? And then it takes this absolute sideswipe of the grandmother kind of reminiscing about this black boy that she dobbed into her brothers and who ended up being Emmett Till and who was murdered by her brothers, by her brother and her husband. The humor as a white reader, you're never comfortable because you even though you're laughing, you're kind of like, can I be laughing? Should I be laughing? But I think that's the point. I think he's imagined living like this all the time. Yeah, so I loved it. I mean, I think that is an incredible effect to have on a reader. Yeah, it's very unforgettable. I won't forget this book for a long time.
Well, there you go. So that was our, we're still catching up on the Booker shortlist. Didn't quite work for me, but I think it's a very strong book.
I think it would make a great book club book. I mean, even this discussion that we've had, I think we could go into lots of different areas.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. Well, that's it. That was The Trees by Percival Everett. And coming up, Amanda and I will be reading The Marriage Portrait by Maggie O'Farrell. And I think we're also doing Crossroads by Jonathan Franzen. And Annie, what are we doing next? We don't know yet. Annie and I will discuss our next book and we'll post that up online. So you'll be able to check on Instagram is the best place. So you can follow us on Facebook at Books on the Go. You can email us at booksonthegopodcast@gmail.com. And I'm on Instagram, Twitter and Litzy at A. Bailey Karras. And Annie?
I'm on Instagram and Twitter at Mr. _Annie.
Fabulous. We'll see you next week. Bye for now.
Bye.